Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're on board today. Most voters played according to the script in yesterday's Super Tuesday primaries and caucuses. Republicans moved a step closer to nominating Donald Trump. He now has 777 of the 1,215 delegates he needs to lock up the Republican nomination, and they took a giant leap in that direction this morning when Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. Haley did not play according to the Republican script when she made her announcement, speaking out against isolationism and pointedly refusing to endorse Mr. Trump. She called on him to earn the votes of those who supported her. One of the voters Mr. Trump has won over appears to be Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who announced his endorsement of Mr. Trump this morning. And this week, courtesy of the Supreme Court, Trump has also moved a step closer to having some of the legal cases that have been brought against him delayed until after the November election. Another senator announced her intention to retire at the end of this term. Kyrsten Sinema, who left the Democratic Party in 2022, said, quote, "Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will leave the Senate at the end of this year. I believe in my approach, but it's not what America wants right now," she said in a video released yesterday afternoon. Sinema joins six other members of the Senate, including Maryland's Ben Cardin, who are retiring at the end of their terms. 49 House members are retiring as well. Joining me with perspective about the presidential race and all things political is E.J. Dion, the award-winning syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. He is also a government professor at Georgetown University, a visiting professor at Harvard, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and I am proud to say a wonderful friend of this show. E.J., always great to talk to you.
It is always a joy to be with you, and boy, do we have a lot to talk about today.
Boy, indeed we do. Let's start with Nikki Haley. It's interesting that in the punditry spectrum, I've heard everything, and when people speculate about her future, I've heard everything from she's still a possible vice presidential choice of Donald Trump, all the way to she'll never endorse Trump. In fact, she'll run as a no-labels candidate against him. Where do you stand in that very long arc?
Well, I quit the prognosticators union at midnight on election night in 2016. So I just want to tell that to everybody out there. But I don't think either of those things are going to happen. I can't imagine that Trump would want someone who has said the things about him and has shown the independence that she showed, particularly in the later parts of her campaign. So I can't imagine Trump picking her as a vice president. It would actually be a good idea for him, but I don't think he's going to do it. And I think she's kind of ruled out the no labels route, although that's a possibility. I'm not sure where she ends up right now, because a lot, obviously, I think if Trump wins, she is isolated from power and politics for a long time. I suppose it depends in part on what she does in the campaign. But I found a statement she made fascinating because it's such a great test of Trump. She said, as you alluded to in the opener, it is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. Trump is used to Republicans bowing down to him. He is not accustomed to Republicans making demands on him. If you look just at his concession speech, or his victory speech rather, last night. First of all, he looked really tired, and it was such a mediocre speech that even the Fox News commentators, I watched it on Fox, who were pro-Trump, basically expressed disappointment with it. But there was no outreach in that speech at all, no outreach to Haley, no outreach to the parts of the party that didn't support him. And really old stuff, a regurgitation that the country, it was as if we were in the midst of something combining the Great Depression and the plague, under Joe Biden. So I think this is going to be a very interesting dance between the two of them, but more importantly for Trump and the nation, an interesting dance between Trump and the very significant constituency that showed in the Republican primaries that it doesn't really like him.
What about Joe Biden? How does he win over voters for Nikki Haley. He certainly made a direct appeal to them in a statement that the White House issued this morning, or the campaign, I should say, issued this morning.
Well, so I think over the last few weeks, the media, the punditry has focused a lot on Biden's weaknesses. And certainly he's got some issues that he's got to deal with, his age above all, less enthusiasm among the young, some defections, not so much to Trump, but to possible third party voting or non-voting from young people, people upset about his policies on Gaza. And some weakening in the Latino vote. All those problems are there. And the polls are way too close for his comfort. And some are, at least some of them are, show Trump with a lead. What I think that you saw yesterday and have seen for a while are the openings Biden has and the problems Trump has. I was really struck in the results yesterday that first, there were only about 800,000 votes against Biden in the Democratic primaries. He was getting somewhere around 86% of the vote. Trump was getting around 77% of the Republican vote overall. But he was really hurting in the suburbs, in the sort of relatively well-off suburbs, Fairfax County near us. Haley actually carried Fairfax with 57%. Hennepin County around Minneapolis, sort of that metro vote, Haley got 45%. Mecklenburg County, where Charlotte is, Haley got 45%. That's really bad news for Trump because this election will be decided in significant parts in the metro areas and by a lot of suburban voters who may not fully like Joe Biden, may think of him as too much of an old labor Democrat, which is something I personally like about him, but doesn't appeal to them. They tend to be moderate to conservative on economics, but they also don't like chaos and they tend to like democracy. And I think a lot of the Biden campaign, not all of it, but a lot of it, and some of his State of the Union on Thursday will be directed to those kind of middle class and well-off suburban voters to say, you may not agree with me on everything. You may think I'm too old, but you know that I know how to run the government and I don't produce chaos. And I think he'll pick up a lot of Haley's rhetoric about Trump as the chaos candidate.
E.J. Dionne is a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and a scholar at the Brookings Institution. If you have a question for E.J. Dionne, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. You are indeed listening to Midday, and we are grateful for that. You had a column a couple of days ago, E.J., in which you talked about the paradox of Bidenism, the Scranton Joe persona that he has, cultivated over many years in politics, makes him the champion of the working man. But in fact, the biggest divide between Trump and Biden seems to be that Trump is somehow figured out how to position himself as the champion of the working class, and it's those college-educated voters like the ones in the suburbs you're talking about and elsewhere, the metropolitan areas, that are glomming on to Biden. This is despite the fact that the biggest beneficiaries of the investments that Biden programs have made have been in those places that are, you describe them in your column as employment distressed. Clearly, half of all these sector investments have gone to these distressed counties. Those are the red counties. Those are the Trump counties. So they're benefiting from the programs that Mr. Biden has pushed through Congress, but they're not responding to him the way that they used to respond to that Scranton Joe persona. So how does he work that through?
It's a big issue, and I think it's a personal issue for him. I've covered Biden for a long time. And I think probably if he claims he doesn't read the polls, I suspect he does. I think one of the things that probably pains him most personally is that he really does look at himself as someone who champions the working class, the working middle class, sometimes we call it these days, or he calls it these days. And I've had conversations with him where he has pointedly criticized Democrats for not understanding working class voters and not understanding the situation they're in. And yet he has done a lot for them, for that constituency. If you look at what real wages and where they've risen, they have risen much more in the bottom two quintiles, much more for the bottom 40% than they have for people at the top under Biden. As you mentioned, these investments, there's a great study by my colleagues at Brookings about where the investments are going that are spurred by these three big Biden programs, infrastructure, chips and science, and the climate investments. They're going to places that vote for Trump for a large part. They're going not to the big Democratic metro areas. They're going to what are called micropolitan areas, smaller areas that really need these kinds of blue collar jobs. I think that for the purposes of this election, the white working class vote in particular has been straying from the Democrats, going back to Nixon with his Southern strategy and the Reagan Democrats. But Biden does need a significant enough share of them. He's got to cut Trump's margins in this group enough to carry key states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And so I think he is going to be much more explicit, both about what he's done and what he would continue to do for working class people. I think the other place it's showing itself as a problem is there's a real decay in the Democratic vote among Latinos, and again, particularly the Latino working class, and even some decline, not as sharp as among Latinos, among Black working class voters. So that I think the Biden campaign is going to be on two tracks because they've got to turn out this more upscale suburban vote if they're going to win the election. But they need, he's not going to restore the New Deal coalition, but he needs enough working class votes to carry those states. And I think the State of the Union, I think, will reflect this sort of two-track strategy, a lot on chaos and democracy for the middle class and upper middle class voters, and a lot on what he's done and what he's going to do for working class voters. I think the improvement of the economy may help him a bit among working class voters.
Yeah, and we'll have, of course, you know, Lord knows what will happen to that. It's going to go up and down between now and November. There's been a lot of reporting, I think most recently by Evan Osnos in The New Yorker, who did a big, long interview with Joe Biden, a guy that, like you, he's, you know, covered him for a long time, of what some folks refer to as the poke the bear strategy, and that Joe Biden has been chomping at the bit for Super Tuesday to be over so that Trump essentially has the nomination locked up in the general election festivities can begin. Poking the bear, getting Trump's goat, running ads that you know criticize Trump and his thin skin, hoping that Trump will make mistakes and just, you know, say even more outlandish and outrageous things. Is there such thing as a mistake for Donald Trump in this climate? I mean, it seems like whatever he says, however outlandish and however bigoted and however ill-informed and mendacious the things are that he utters, it doesn't seem to affect his base one bit.
Well, but this election is not I think you're broadly right about that. But I think this election is not about Trump's base. Trump's base will continue to be Trump's base. And he famously said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose those votes. And he's probably right about that. So that's not where these are aimed at. These are aimed precisely at, you know, what people sometimes call the double haters or the double doubters, voters who don't really like Biden all that much, but they're not crazy about Donald Trump. And those are the voters that Biden is hoping to get by saying, you know, look, I'm old, but at least I'm about the future. Also, by the way, we're not that far apart in age. And look at this nonsense that Trump is peddling. Look at this point in his speech where he totally lost his way and kind of dribbled off. Look at these mistakes he made. And then for, you know, some other groups of voters who may be undecided, you know, some of the most outlandish things Trump says will say to them, you know, we may not be crazy about Biden, but we can't have four more years of Trump. And so I do think the end of the primaries open up that opportunity. You know, the Biden people, and I think the Evan Osnos very good piece quoted this, like to cite polling where a lot of people said they weren't sure Trump was going to be the Republican nominee. Well, now he is. And so let the fight begin. And you're quite right. The Biden people have been waiting to open this fight.
What does Biden need to accomplish Thursday night in the State of the Union address?
Well, first of all, I think he needs to look strong. He needs to look funny, you know, have some sense of humor. Personally, I think there might be an occasion to deal with a bit with the age issue straight on and, you know, make an argument that he's about the future and that, you know, and I, you know, and what he's been able to get done by experience. But I think most important, he's got to lay out something about the future because elections are not just about the past. People want to know, what are you going to do in 4 years? And I think he's already got some of that agenda in place with the parts of his program that didn't pass. I really think the whole idea of a family agenda, I think the word better is the key Biden word, you know, not revolutionize things, but make things better. Better lives for families with family leave, better child care, better pre-K. I think a better deal for young people with, not only debt forgiveness, which he's been trying to push, but also helping young people get both job training and post-high school training to get decent jobs and get a leg up in the housing market. So I think he needs a series of programs like that that are about improving people's lives that are visionary enough, but also realistic enough. I think, secondly, he's got to talk about rights. He's going to talk a lot about freedom. The word freedom, I think, will be very important. And he's going to talk about reproductive rights. And, you know, the fight over IVF has really ignited a whole new form of opposition to what the Supreme Court did with three Trump appointees on abortion and reproductive rights. It's not just about abortion, but also about voting rights and about the rights of parents. Now, I think he's going to flip around the rights of parents issue, you know, when it comes to the books in schools, and that a small minority of parents should not be able to censor the books that your kids read. So I think there'll be that. I think there'll be a strong push on democracy in general. And I think he's going to talk about democracy abroad. And I'm sure he's going to talk about Ukraine and the dangers of selling Ukraine out right now. That's both a campaign issue, but it's a very live issue in Congress. That's part of what he's got to do. But I think he's got to, at the end of that speech, whatever clip people see of it, they got to look at it and say, this guy is ready to be president for another term, because there is that doubt out there because of his age. And, you know, the Biden folks can complain about how much attention it gets. And maybe it does get, it becomes like, but what about the emails and distracts attention from what should be covered about Trump? Nonetheless, they got to deal with it. And they've got to have that in mind when they prepare him for the speech.
Let me ask you about the Senate as we finish up here this afternoon. Ruben Gallego will square off against Kerry Lake in Arizona. Kyrsten Sinema is out of that race, so that complication is eliminated. How do you see that one? How do you see the race in Texas? Colin Allred won a very crowded primary for the right to run against Ted Cruz. Do you think he has any chance there? And I want to ask you about Maryland, here in Maryland, with Larry Hogan announcing his candidacy. He's likely the Republican nominee in a race against either David Trone or Angela Alsobrooks. Are all three of these states in play? What do you think?
Let me start with Gallego. He is clearly the underdog. Texas has returned to being a very Republican state. But a lot of people just aren't crazy about Ted Cruz. He's not widely liked. He won by, I think it was 3 points over.
Just to clarify, you're talking about Colin Allred in Texas, not Gallego.
I'm sorry.
Yep,
I
no
said
problem.
Ruben Gallego. I meant Colin Allred. Look at the right part of the notes you just scribbled down. Colin Allred. He's a very good candidate. He's a very appealing guy. I think he does know how to run in Texas. I think he knows how to be progressive enough for progressives and moderate enough for moderates. So I think he'll give Cruz a race, and Democrats need, you know, Democrats are playing so much defense that they need, some races where they can put Republicans on the defensive. Florida is the other one like that. But he's definitely the underdog. I think Gallego's got a good shot he's been running well in the polls in Arizona, but boy, that's a tight state. The good news for him is The lake is really unpopular, and they got, she's an extreme Trump candidate. A lot of moderate voters, including Republican inclined moderate voters, have just not liked MAGA candidates. And so I think that he's very lucky to be running against Lake. Maryland is exactly the opposite for Democrats. Governor Hogan was very popular as governor. But I've always sensed, I've lived in Maryland now for a long time, and it's a bit like my home, native state of Massachusetts, where voters will frequently elect Republican governors, partly because they want to put a check on the state legislature. They think Democrats have run the place a long time, but they make a distinction between governors and whom they send down the road to Washington for federal office. Mitt Romney ran for the Senate, was quite a popular governor in Massachusetts, ran for the Senate, and Ted Kennedy beat him pretty soundly. So I think that he has real challenges because of the identification of the National Republican Party, but he is certainly the only Republican who could create a race in Maryland. And I think it's going to be a fight Democrats wish they didn't have to wage, but they're going to have to wage it.
Yeah, and indeed, in Texas, perhaps, and in Maryland, both. If it's anything, it's a distraction with money. People are going to have to spend money that that they didn't necessarily think they might have to spend
No, they
before.
did
So.
not want to have to spend money in Maryland, and you've got a bunch of media markets that aren't cheap here. It's not the most expensive state, but it's not cheap to campaign in Maryland. So yeah, they with any other candidate, they could take it for granted. With Hogan, they can't.
Yeah, indeed. Well, EJ, that's all the time we have. I always enjoy speaking with you and look forward to the next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
EJ
Bye.
Dion is a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And up next, a conversation about a new development in Baltimore's Mondawmin neighborhood. Tim Regan of the Whiting Turner Contracting Company and Joe Jones of the Center for Urban Families join me to talk about the village at Mondawmin. On the other side of a quick break, I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.